A jail stint can really disrupt someone's life. You can lose a job, a relationship, or thousands of dollars on fees, fines, and bail.
Have I ever gone to jail? Yeah, I just got out, actually.
If he doesn't show up to court, you gotta pay the $50,000.
No ring exchange, no kiss the bride. There's no glamour in a jailhouse wedding.
Off the Block. All six episodes tracing the path from city block to jail block and back are now available on KCRW's iTunes page.
Hi, I'm Frances Anderton, and this is DNA. A poet hands over the reins at the LA River.
I think that he had such a sense of poetic vision about it that people couldn't help but become enamored with his vision and make it their own. The river has become a success story because people fell in love with Lewis himself.
Marissa Christensen pays tribute to Lewis McAdams, co-founder of Friends of the LA River. And we'll hear about McAdams' musical foray. First up, though, Fidel Castro has died after ruling Cuba for almost 60 years. One of the impacts of his long-held control was that its capital city, Havana, developed in ways unlike other cities in the Americas. So what's going to happen to Havana now? Rosa Loewinger is a materials conservator with offices in Miami and Los Angeles. She was born in Cuba and leads architectural preservation tours there.
The Cuban Revolution halted all private development in the island. And that created an unusual situation in the 20th century and now 21st century world, which is that very few buildings were torn down to make way for large modern real estate development projects. And what that means is that Havana and Cuba as a whole has a much larger percentage of historic architecture in place than practically any other country in the Western Hemisphere.
And although other countries have been investing in Havana and there has been private development in the last, say, 20 years, still it's been far less than, as you said, other cities. With Fidel Castro's passing, what do you think are the prospects for a really big upsurge in development on the island, and how is that being thought about? Is it welcomed?
Well, here's the thing. The development in Cuba has already begun. Certainly since the Obama administration opened up relations with Cuba and made travel by Americans easier, there's been a great mad rush to build hotels, for example. And the impact of that is complicated. On the one hand, it means that there's buildings being developed, historic properties are being restored. But one of the problems with it all is that when you do preservation really fast, you very frequently get it wrong, and some irreparable damage is being done to properties that shouldn't be treated the way they're being treated.
For anyone that hasn't visited Havana, can you describe briefly what that older urban fabric feels like?
Yes. The best way I can think of to describe Havana in particular, it is like if you were driving through a pop-up book of the history of the architecture of the Western Hemisphere, that is what Havana is. You start in one end of the city, and you are looking at buildings from the early 16th century. Then you see buildings from the 17th, the 18th, the 19th, the 20th, every style that has affected the Western Hemisphere, from Baroque to Neo-Baroque to Spanish Colonial, Art Nouveau, it's all there in varying stages of disrepair. But what you see when you go to Havana is the influence of the entire world on this one city.
Amazing, amazing, on this small island.
Yeah.
Now, one thing that really seems interesting about Fidel Castro relative to other communist dictators, I suppose, is that he didn't go in for massive urban renewal. He didn't go in for building great wide Ceausescu-like boulevards. He didn't go in for building, it seems, kind of monuments to himself. Is that fair to say? And why do you think that was?
That is fair to say, and I'm not sure why it was. I do know that before the revolution in the 1950s, there was a plan afoot in urban design circles in Cuba to re-envision Havana as a modern city with wide boulevards of the sort that we're talking about, to create a sort of banking center the way Brickell Avenue in Miami is now. And it is possible that that lack of development of those wide boulevards in that Ceausescu manner is a reaction to what was being thought through before. But also, there's another thing. In Cuba, you will find very few, if any, images of Fidel Castro in the city. The images are of Che Guevara, and the images are of Camilo Cienfuegos and other leaders of the revolution. Castro is practically not seen in terms of the urban fabric.
I was very struck by that very thing when I did visit Cuba some time ago. And at the time, I believe I was told that Castro made a choice not to have imagery of himself, that he understood that there was kind of a danger to sort of the cult of the individual in buildings and in visuals.
That is my understanding of it as well. Although they certainly did the cult of the individual with Che Guevara, but you can do that around a dead leader more easily than around a live one, because then you always have the possibility of toppling those images once the revolution changes. I don't know. It's one way of thinking about it, because I can't imagine that Fidel Castro did anything along those lines that didn't have his own interests at the foundation of it. You know, it's not like this was a leader who did not want to have the central position in every decision that was made. So if the decision was made not to portray himself, that clearly was a decision designed to foment that cult of personality, not to reduce it.
Sure, sure. However, he did leave one very important landmark. Let's talk about the art schools.
Yes. The Havana Art Schools are a series of five buildings that are built on the grounds of the former Havana Country Club. They were designed by a team that was led by a Cuban architect, Ricardo Porro, and two Italians whom he brought on board to help design these five structures. It was an idea that Fidel Castro and Che Guevara came up with to take the grounds of the most elitist institution in Cuban culture of the pre-revolutionary period and turn them into the people's educational environment. These are five buildings in this kind of rural, semi-rural, semi-suburban landscape made out of brick rather than concrete, which was the main material of building in the 1950s. And they have these exquisite forms that were hearkening to earlier.
Yes, the sort of primitive modernism.
Yes, primitive modernism, exactly. And by the way, these are buildings that are beloved internationally. They're in varying states of disrepair. It was built at a moment in the revolution where there was a great deal of idealism in the early years, and when the realities of what these things actually cost came to be, then certain changes had to be made. And some of the schools actually remained unfinished and remain unfinished to this day. But in their decay, they're quite glorious.
And lastly, in terms of an architectural imprint, during the period of Soviet engagement with Cuba, the Russians built in Havana. So tell us about that imprint.
Well, you know, the Russians didn't build that much. What they did build was an extraordinary-looking embassy that looks literally like a giant sword stuck into the ground in the Miramar neighborhood of Cuba. I mean, I think if you study the buildings of Cuba, you can read the history of the country, not only the country, but the entire political landscape of the last 500 years is evident in Havana, and that's one of the things that I study and am very interested in. Now, there's a lot of decay in place. A lot of buildings are being lost. But the main threat right now is bad development, and not just tearing down of buildings, because that has not happened yet, but the idea of encroachment of gigantic structures, if that starts to happen, and also from within Cuba itself, if poor preservation is done in the name of getting things done fast so that they can be developed quickly for the tourist market. We're in a moment where it is critical. And right now, though the Cubans have done an excellent job of preserving a lot of this, we're in a position right now where the limits of what Cubans have been doing on their own is being challenged, and it's a moment where there needs to be an international dialogue, Cuba to the outside world.
That was Rosa Loewinger, Cuban-born materials conservator based in LA and Miami. She's also author of the book Tropicana Nights, The Life and Times of the Legendary Cuban Nightclub. I'm Frances Anderton, you're listening to DNA. Now, one of the notable absences in the urban fabric of Havana is billboards and commercial signs. The only signage over the last few decades has tended to be political posters. Juan Angelino, however, is leading an effort to restore the commercial neon signs of the 1950s. His name is Al Nodal, and he's the former cultural affairs director for the city of Los Angeles. He was born in Cuba and visits the island frequently. He happened to be at Havana Airport when the news of Fidel Castro's death broke.
Well, there was sort of a sense of stunned silence in the whole place. I mean, basically, they ran the gamut from grief to totally quietness. People weren't really talking. Everybody was really either glued to their phones or just quietly walking. So there was really a sort of a feeling of suspension of time. There's a sense of profound change there. It's been coming on that with Fidel Castro's passing, it really has been, you know, brought to the fore. There's a lot of hope and there's a lot of fear mixed together. And I think there's a general optimism in Cuba by the Cubans that things are going to, you know, move in the right direction.
And you've been going to Cuba regularly over many, many years.
Yes.
And you are actively engaged with Havana's urban fabric. Tell us how.
Basically, you know, simply stated, I'm trying to return some of the historic fabric of the post-war Havana to the city and maybe other cities in Cuba. It sort of reflects the relationship to the old cars plying the streets, all the neon signs of Havana that have been sitting there quietly for about 60 years are coming back to life. And, you know, these signs are the architectural equivalent of the old cars. They're from the same era. So we've been working as a public art project and a historic preservation project over the last 2 years, restoring signs, and we're slowly getting them relit. We've fixed 60 of them already around the city. We're getting a lot of small companies and small restaurants and et cetera that are wanting to put up their own signs. So it's starting to map out in neon the commercial changes in Havana. So it's very interesting what's going on there.
But what you're talking about, when you say you're working to restore the visuals of post-war Havana, you're talking about the 1950s, sort of the mid-century period, mm-hmm. which was also the Batista period, the period when Havana was America's playground.
Yes, the 40s, the 50s, to the 60s. The historic signage of Cuba was all over Havana, and, you know, it became a symbol of Yankee imperialism, and a lot of them got taken down. Some of them during the revolution got knocked down. But slowly, because of the efforts of the government and in other fields, the whole commercialism sort of faded away and the signs faded away with it. So there are thousands and thousands of them. We've counted about 400 of them at this point that have survived. The interesting part of it is that Cuba, you know, it has been an economy with very little supplies and materials. So many of the metal from a lot of these signs were used to fix up the cars. So
to fix up the American mid-50s, early 60s cars.
Yeah, so there's a symbiotic relationship between the old cars and the old signs, and that's what we're doing. We're basically trying to bring some beauty back to the city. It's a beautiful city, but it's a very dark city. So we're trying to bring the light back.
And something that might be interesting to Angelinos is how much some L.A. designers were actually involved with Cuba's building in the 1950s. Welton Beckett, for example,
yes.
built the Havana Hilton.
Yeah. I mean, before the relationships got closed down, Cuba and the U.S. were joined at the hip. There was a major relationship at every level between Cuba and the United States. So many of the architects hopscotch back and forth from the U.S. to Cuba and created major pieces of architecture there as well. Cuba is now really getting a new sense of design. All the commercial activities that are going on, the private commercial activities, are generating a new sense of design, a new sense of fashion. All of that is coming back to Havana now, and it's wonderful to see.
That's Al Nodal, former cultural affairs director for the City of L.A. and founder of the Lumens Project. I'm Frances Anderton, you're listening to DNA. Coming up after this break, how did an ornery poet build a movement around the L.A. River?
This podcast is produced by nonprofit radio station KCRW. Support the podcasts you enjoy by donating at kcrw.com/join.
Back with DNA. I'm Frances Anderton. When engineers in the late 1930s conceived the idea of encasing a 51-mile sprawling waterway in concrete, it made sense. Two massive storms had just caused floods that killed hundreds of people and destroyed thousands of homes.
Disaster, destruction, and death descend on five Southern California counties. Tons of water submerged 30,000 square miles of populous beach and valley towns in the Los Angeles area. What once were streets and boulevards, now are raging torrents of swirling floodwater.
But when a poet named Lewis McAdams and friends gathered at the river in the mid-1980s, that engineering feat had come to represent an ugly barrier and a repudiation of nature.
I think of the river the way it reads in the Sam Shepard story, Cruise in Paradise, a huge concrete serpent, a dumping ground for murder victims. I think of the river beside a freeway off-ramp as rollerbladers bent into its spandexed buttocks rotating, roll downstream.
That's Lewis McAdams on a spoken word album named Good Grief. Hear more about that coming up. Now, you may know Lewis McAdams from his work as president of Friends of the LA River, leading the chorus for reimagining our concrete flood control channel. This week, he hands over the torch to a new executive director, Marissa Christensen. We'll hear from her in a moment. First, though, let's go back to 1986, when Lewis McAdams and two friends cut a hole in the fence blocking access to the river. That was just the start of actions that birthed a movement.
Me and this guy Roger Wong and Pat Patterson went to the confluence of the river coming down from Pasadena in the Arroyo Seco and asked the river if we could speak for it in the human realm, and it didn't say no. So, of course, we took our instructions from the river. And another aspect of it was Gary Snyder, the great American poet, came to my ex-wife and I's house in Silver Lake and gave a reading on our deck for about 10 or 15 people, poems about rivers. And that night he gave a reading to 1,000 people downtown. And he said he'd come to the first meeting at Friends of the Los Angeles River that afternoon. And people laughed, and he said, "Don't laugh." And from then on, those are pretty much all the marching orders that we have. But it's not even a march, it's a dance.
McAdams says the original goal of the Friends was modest.
FOLAR is based on the idea of fun. It's not an environmental organization per se. It's a place where people gather along the river to enjoy their lives along a river that most people didn't think was a river until very recently.
But the fun did turn into a force of advocacy for the other LA River, which has led to major developments and the attraction to the river of a lot of people. Its fortunes have been changed.
That's a good thing, right?
Well, is it? What do you think?
I mean, I think that Moses didn't get to the promised land, and it doesn't look like I'm going to get to see any concrete taken out. But we start taking out concrete, I say the work is just beginning. The challenge has been joined. And when the battle is over, who will wear the crown?
Under Lewis McAdams' direction, FOLAR grew into what the LA Times called one of the leading conservationist organizations in California, with a list of 40,000 supporters. FOLAR and a growing number of river activists, designers, and planners also did much of the work that led to approval of a $1.6 billion federal project to restore natural habitat, widen the channel, create wetlands, and expand access and bike trails along an 11-mile section of riverbed north of downtown. Now, a byproduct of this work was the founding of another nonprofit, the Los Angeles River Revitalization Corporation, now renamed River LA. Its mandate was to shepherd development along the river. That group reached out to Frank Gehry with the goal of having him master plan all 51 miles of the LA River. And this is where things got sticky, with Lewis McAdams publicly speaking out against what he called another one-size-fits-all scheme for the river.
And I don't think that having one solution, even if it's as brilliant as an idea as Frank Gehry's, a single purpose solution is not really the answer.
River LA and Gary Partners make clear that, one, they have no one-size-fits-all plan, and that also they are considering all 51 miles of the river, not just the stretch within the city of LA. Now, McAdams hands off the reins to Marissa Christensen, until now a senior policy director for FOLAR. So what has she learned from McAdams, and what are her goals for the group now?
People love Lewis, and he's such an icon, and I certainly am not an icon. So standing on his shoulders and certainly not filling his shoes, because that's just not possible, but walking on his path, I think, is the task at hand, and also the biggest honor and challenge. I think Lewis's singular biggest accomplishment is that he created this movement.
Given that he's a quirky, idiosyncratic guy who writes poetry and talks in kind of elliptical ways at times, mm-hmm. how do you think he managed to pull this off?
Well, I think that's exactly how he managed to pull it off. I think that he had such a sense of poetic vision about it that people couldn't help but become enamored with his vision and make it their own. I think that if he had been more of sort of a technical wonk or a politician about it, it may have taken a different shape, or it may not have been successful. I mean, I think ultimately the river has become a success story because people fell in love with Lewis himself.
So now the FOLAR is at a much different stage in its growth, and it has become interwoven with the politics and questions of development around the river. And that's the moment that you're taking the helm. There has been some, I guess, friction over the last year or so having to do with the direction the river's going. And so how much did this change of leadership have to do with Lewis McAdams' health problems? And by health, he had a stroke. And how much had to do with the sort of rising tensions, I guess, between FOLAR and River LA and some of the other sort of political challenges?
Sure. You know, that's a really good question. And I'm realizing that that's going to be something we have to really clearly address. This succession plan has been in place for what I'm told is at least 3 years. So it didn't have anything to do with political tension. It certainly happened long before his health crisis. But of course, his health has sort of made it clear that it really is time.
So what do you consider to be your task?
I really think that the best future for the river is a collaborative one. You know, this is a 51-mile beast that has been balkanized and fought over and channelized by forces that didn't understand all that it had to offer. And so I think that it's going to take all of us to actually push it in the right direction. Now, with any conflict that we've had, anytime a movement is created and different personalities are involved, people have differing views and they have a very sort of specific vision in their head of how things should go. But I think that both FOLAR and River LA and all of the other organizations involved are smart enough, mature enough, professional enough, and dedicated enough to the river to be able to move past that and actually collaborate. And I really do plan on making sure that we strengthen our partnerships for the benefit of the river and for communities.
And lastly, Marissa, do you yourself write poetry?
You know, I would never describe myself as a poet, but I certainly do some creative writing, especially when I'm feeling a little bit stressed. And this job is proving to be sort of replete in stress. So I'm sure I will be doing my own bit of writing, absolutely.
That was Marissa Christensen, new executive director of Friends of the LA River. This Thursday, she and Lewis McAdams will speak at a press conference and reception for McAdams, taking place from 4 till 6 at the Los Angeles River Center and Gardens. All are welcome. So you've heard about McAdams' work as a river whisperer and poet. Well, now he's working on a memoir about his life called Poetry and Politics. But who knew he had another life as a musician? It turns out he's one half of a collaboration with longtime musician and performance artist called The Dark Bob. Gideon Brower met them when they were putting together their CD.
My name is Lewis McAdams.
And I'm The Dark Bob.
We worked on this thing for 6 or 7 months, and we didn't know really what to call it. except words and music.
It has something to do with poetry. It has something to do with music. But I really haven't heard anything quite like it.
A very sad and lonely man is singing to you, Anne, wherever you might be tonight, whatever is your road. The clock is ticking in the bathroom, and the shade sends crickets into reveries of hush.
The Dark Bob and I have known each other for a long time. We sort of reconnected. My 70th birthday party was a benefit for Friends of the Los Angeles River, and the Dark Bob was the MC.
My goal at this event was to just freak everyone out.
And did you succeed?
I think I did. It was a very formal affair. It needed a bit of chaos.
Yeah. One of the pieces is Old Age, Sickness, Suffering, and Death, which we think probably will make a great single.
Old age, sickness, suffering, and death. I'm gonna laugh with you till my very last breath.
It certainly has hit written all over it.
Yeah, that's what we...
the title especially.
You put kind of a party track underneath it. Sounds like people having a good time.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk a little bit about that?
It was such a depressing lyric. It was the best way to compliment it and really to turn it into a celebration of life.
Old age, sickness, suffering, and death was really an attempt to laugh at death. And, you know, you might as well, can't dance.
The doctor told me, take a walk. I said, Doc, you take a walk.
I am in no sense a musician, so for most of the music, I really relied on what the Dark Bob had to say and do.
And Dark Bob, were you presented with sort of essentially completed lyrics, and you would then find a music bed for it or a way to present it musically?
Something close to that. Sometimes it happened where I could craft music just around his words, and then there are times when Lewis needed to say, you know, his feelings one way or another about the feel of where we should go. And in an odd way, what was once a poem suddenly starts looking like a lyric and fitting it, giving a cadence to it that's a little different than maybe a reading was a lot of fun.
I think of the river the way it reads in the Sam Shepard story, Cruisin' Paradise, a huge concrete serpent, a dumping ground for murder victims. I think of the river beside a freeway off-ramp as rollerbladers bent into its spandexed buttocks rotating, roll downstream.
Just listening to some of the lyrics, what I was picking up on a little bit was the idea that stuff that's been built up, covered over, is equivalent somehow or leads to somehow people being separated from their own sort of deeper selves or truer selves. Do you see...
That's a great perception, actually. That's better than I could have said it, actually. It's good. Part of what I do, I think, is to make the invisible visible. I mean, and I think we've begun to accomplish that with the Los Angeles River. When I started it, I thought all I had to do was to make people excited about the possibilities of change. I quickly realized that the first thing I had to do is convince people the river even existed.
That was Lewis McAdams. The CD he made with the Dark Bob is called Good Grief. Gideon Brower's story was produced with support from KCRW's Independent Producer Project. I'm Frances Anderton, and that's it for today's DNA. Avishai Artsy is the show's producer. Ray Guana mixed this episode. Special thanks to Jason Groman and Jackie Liu. Thank you very much for listening.